Paul, can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes, we can hear you now. Sorry to keep you waiting, but I think maybe some of the stuff that you heard wasn't exactly boring.
No. Let me tell you something. If the only meeting right now I could attend every day is listening to Dr. Brittle, I would do it because I think he's probably one of the most, not just technically sound experts, but I think the way he delivers the message, I like the way he speaks. It's very, very engaging, and I always learn something from him. Mm-hmm. So I'm very appreciative calling in early. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Let me try and introduce you, but it's probably easiest if you do it yourself. You're a health research methodologist and former Washington, D.C. COVID pandemic advisor, Trump administration senior COVID pandemic official at the HHS. You're educated at the University of Toronto, Oxford, and McMaster, right?
Yes. Yes.
And of course, there's lots more to say about you. You had a sane strategy at the beginning of the pandemic. You were opposed to the lockdowns, but something happened. What went wrong?
In terms of with me or just generally the overall response? Well, let me just say it this way. You know, I know we have compressed time, but it's always interesting to hear other people. So let me just say my views quickly. Mm-hmm. I came out of McMaster. It's very interesting quickly that after I finished with Oxford, I came back to Canada, and I was actually going to read for a doctorate at Johns Hopkins in biological warfare. And I had been in communications with Dr. Donald Henderson over the years, who led the eradication of smallpox. Because I had done a program, a short certificate in biowarfare, Johns Hopkins in 2001. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in weaponization of pathogen in terms of how persons could do that. And principally to see, you know, how bad people in this world, bad actors could wage war on the battlefield now with pathogen. So anyway, but I took it up with Dr. Guyatt, Gordon Guyatt at McMaster. He was the founder of evidence-based medicine with Dr. Dave Sackett. So I did my doctorate there and my postdoc. And I remain connected with these people at McMaster in research methodology because I provide research methods, evidence-based medicine, technical input. Germane to this discussion is it's very interesting. In mid of 2019, WHO and the Pan American Health, the Americas division, kind of training program for low and middle income countries. Based on my training from in evidence-based medicine, everything to do around research, etc., for the poorer countries in Latin America, Caribbean, etc. So I was doing that from around June of 2019. Then when this thing began to hit in China or rear its head, though we now have, you know, more credible indications that from as early as October 2019, this may have been already in the world. But around January, February 2020, WHO asked me to change my role with them and to be a COVID pandemic advisor in everything to do with evidence-based, because at that time they were getting a lot of information coming at them from different places, and they did not know, to be quite honest, no one knew what was going on, and no one at that point, at least from their point of view, didn't know what was really happening. And we were getting all of these reports out of Lombardia and Italy of all these people dying, etc., and turning up to the hospitals and passing away on the sidewalk. So it was a scary time even for me, because we were trying to wrap our arms around this. And so my position changed. I was actually working with them to produce their whatever analysis and reporting on COVID for the first few months. I was in Toronto And I was actually WHO's messaging what was coming out, who I was dealing with at PAHO, and then them to the directorate in Geneva. At the same time, around maybe around end of April, I got a call from DC, from persons who told me that, you know, some of the stuff that I had written and some of the stuff that I had said, they found the White House and persons in the White House, all the way up to POTUS. This is how it was explained to me, found it very controversial, but they were very interested that some of this stuff was, they wanted somebody like myself. The bottom line is, this is what was told. The request was to join the task force behind the scenes so that I could bring my evidence-based medicine approach, more technical, and to provide pushback and a lot of critical eye to everything that they were being fed in the administration to more properly inform them. So I went to DC in May, and in the first couple of weeks, I worked, first 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 1 month, I functioned both as with WHO and the White House and the American administration, because WHO, the PAHO office, didn't want me to resign my job with the Trump administration. They didn't want me to resign my job with them because they felt that I would be their conduit or connection to the administration. The administration, I had discussions with the highest levels and told me that if I could find a way to collaborate, remain collaborating with WHO PAHO, we could share information that we could share so it could benefit everyone involved. So I was actually in the middle trying to balance this collaboration between both. And it took on, is a funny thing, it took on more political lenses because at that point, President Trump was trying to, not trying, he had withdrew from WHO. So while I was in this position, they were withdrawing from WHO, and WHO was asking me, it was funny, if I could broker a conversation in the power office with the administration, which I could not, because that was a shared conflict of interest, and that wasn't even in my role. That was way beyond myself. I mean, I had communications and connections with everyone involved, but I couldn't do something like that. And so I found that a big challenge for me because it was as though my role, my technical role, was changing to a political one from Hupaho's point of view. And that alarmed me. So I also had a meeting then with the ethics commissioner in the White House, in the Trump administration, who told me that I will not be able to continue on anymore in the position where I'm connected to WHO, providing them any input because of the conflict of interest, and which I knew. And we had safeguarded that all along. But at this point, they said, no, we'd like you to resign your position with them. So I resigned from WHO-PAHO and pivoted fully to my role in as a COVID pandemic advisor. So to answer your question, people like Martin Kulldorff, Dr. J. Bhattacharya, Sunita Gupta, I was on line and in line with them, and my position was clear in the beginning. And then Dr. Scott Atlas joined, where we were fighting the administration behind the scenes, because if you remember, when you looked, and I mean, I'm not saying anything that I can't say, I'm just saying things that in what I was dealing with. Because it's not just a technical portion of what we do. We all function in a political world and political environment. Dr. Bridal, as an example, look at his life as probably the world's top virologist, immunologist, and look at the politics that he's found himself in whilst trying to save lives of Canadians and the rest of the world, especially kids. So it's a terrible world that we live in right now, that everything is political. And you can't even work to help anymore without being a political person. Your help must take on a political lens. And if you're not helping on the right side, you're going to be destroyed and smeared. So if you noticed the task force on a daily basis on the podium from the White House, from the administration, they were advocating to keep the society locked down and to keep schools closed and to mask everyone out the wazoo. I'd have to tell you this, that President Trump, from the beginning, once we figured out at the end of April, May, that COVID was amenable to risk stratification and that your baseline risk was prognostic on the severe outcomes, your mortality, et cetera, and we could adopt a more age risk stratified approach if they would let us. So we knew who we were dealing with. We knew this small sliver of the population. We knew 99.5% of the population would survive and do very well if they bump up against COVID. Make no mistake, COVID is a devastating illness for the elderly and persons, and we all know that. I'm not saying anything nobody knows. We talk about this every day. So yes, it's catastrophic for a portion of the population, elderly, comorbid conditions, or vastly obese individuals, et cetera. Even young people with underlying conditions. And all of you are experts, so I don't have to say anything that you don't know. But we knew this. So our job, from trying to blend our technical expertise to the policy, especially Dr. Atlas, was to try and balance the approach and say, look, you can't just lock a society down and harden the lockdown and prolong the lockdowns and keep schools closed when you are just focusing on the impact of the pathogen and you're not considering the harms, the crushing harms from your policy. Your policy must be informed both by the issue at hand, but also the implications of the policy. So our role behind the scenes was almost on a fighting basis. So like Dr. Atlas, tremendous, tremendously bright individual. His job was...
I think we have lost you. You are frozen right now. Okay.
Could you hear me?
Yeah, now you're back. Okay. So exactly. You were explaining how Dr. Atlas and Jay Bhattachary and several others had come to the conclusion that there's no justification for lockdowns or any of these measures because of the survival rate of over 97% or so. So was President Trump, was he going to follow your advice?
Well, as you saw, so let me explain it this way. President Trump was following him as a CEO of the country. He was being informed by the task force because those were the people, those five or six people who headed up the different agencies, but provided guidance. But there was a much bigger group behind the scenes. But he was getting input from a host of people, including HHS and the department, the unit that I was involved with. So he had multiple inputs. But the reality is you saw on that podium daily, a daily fight almost between him and the core task force people around him, like Fauci, et cetera.
Yeah.
Because
these people,
their focus was to keep it locked down and to keep schools closed. But we were getting reports coming up from the different states, okay, routinely, that business owners were committing suicide, employees were committing suicide, and children were self-harming and committing suicide. I mean, we were getting reports that people hung themselves. And it was not because of the virus, it was because of the lockdowns. So you could see the president fighting them on a daily basis to get, and he would plead with different states to open up, open schools. And like we did this survey in around July, and we looked at persons in America 18 to 24. And what we found was about 30% of the persons 18 to 24 in university and colleges in America, which are the healthiest, wellest people, they reported that they seriously considered committing suicide the month before. So the information that was coming up from the different states that the media was not even reporting, because remember, the push was to keep the society locked down. And still, if they had their way, and they're still doing it, was to keep it locked down. But we saw that, and you know, what got lost in all of this was that our approach was you properly secure the high-risk people, and you let the rest of the low-risk, healthy and well in society live largely unfettered lives. And we were not talking about, because then these detractors and persons in the media would say, well, how dare you? You are saying that I'm going to lock the elderly away. Well, first of all, we are saying, well, we are trying to save their lives, because we are saying properly secure them for the first time. You have never secured them. Up to today, the nursing homes in the United States and Canada and UK, et cetera, became killing fields. We lost 80% of people in those nursing homes because staff came into the nursing homes and infected persons. We lost our parents and grandparents because of the staff who infected basically everyone. And still today, the staff brings in the infection. And what we were trying to say is, we are not telling you to take the elderly or the high risk and lock them away. You can find ways of properly they engaging in much more precautions, etc. But I'm not talking about separating them. Of course, in some situations, depending on your risk of a high risk person, they may have to stay away from their family, etc., in their households, secluded. When I say more away, probably eat separately and all these things, but really take the steps. But you let the rest of society live basically unfettered, because the way we've done this before is you allow the healthy in the society to live normally, develop natural immunity, and it is the healthy in society and the well and the younger persons, middle-aged persons like yourself, who develop the immunity and protect the vulnerable. But we did it completely upside down. We locked down the healthy, and we still failed to protect the vulnerable. So it was a catastrophic failure. We looked at every instance of lockdowns across the world up to today. Every country, any setting that did a lockdown, and there's not one instance, not one, where lockdowns were a success in curbing transmission or reducing death. All were failures, every single one. Every mass mandate implementation was a catastrophic failure. Did not stop infections, etc. In fact, we looked at all of the states and all of the countries, and everywhere that a mass mandate was implemented, infections went up. So we were seeing that all of these policies were just failures. They were just, it's like the six foot rule. That was not even based on science. And it was fascinating that we even had studies that showed, if you were for this aerosolized type, because it was not just droplet, there's an aerosolized component. You cannot stop this with a 6 foot distance. You needed 15 feet. There's one study that showed us 27 feet. So it's a funny thing, you know, I was having a discussion with one of the people in the task force. And I said, you know, because when I had arrived there, the 6 foot was already in place. And I said, you know, so tell me, because we were friends at that point chatting. And I said, tell me, how do we come up with the 6 feet? You know, can you at least give me this study? Because I wanted to read up on everything. I came there 2 months after the task force was formed. And they said, oh, well, there's no science. It's just 1 foot. Some said three, some said six. We felt six sounded better. So the thing, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is my view, because I was there, is by his task force. There was some in that task force who did very well by him and really tried, because we were dealing with a difficult situation. But generally, I think that that he was not a scientist, and he tried. He did many, many great things for the United States. I would have to say I was very impressed, particularly in his advocacy for minority persons and helping develop the economy and all of that, and just improving life. So from that point of view, I was willing to accept the request to join. But I think historically, if we look back, I would have to say today that he made two mistakes. One, and I mean, I'm not judging him. I'm just telling you, everybody's entitled to an opinion. One, he failed to fire key people in that task force early on. He failed to fire Fauci and he failed to fire Burks. Why? Up to today, both of them were flat wrong in everything that they stated. I look back on everything that they've stated, all of their models, all of their graphs. I look at everything, and they were just inept and just completely wrong. I think Fauci is a bench scientist, is my view. He should have stayed in the lab just pipetting chemicals. He stepped out of the lane into public health. I can't tell you over 19 months now if there's any one statement, anytime he's come on the news, in any meeting, where anything that he's said, I could go back to a textbook or I could think about it from a basic virology point of view, or immunology or epidemiology point of view, and that he's been correct. I don't even think he understands how wrong he is in everything that he says. And that's another discussion. But I think Trump was wrong in not firing them, and that severely hurt him. And I think whilst we were talking about him going down and probably one of the greatest presidents the United States had and will have, based on how things were looking in January of 2020, I mean, he was looking unstoppable. And a lot of the things he did were tremendous. But I think if he does not come forward very soon and bulletproof and button up the situation with these vaccines as they apply to children, I think he will go wrong as probably one of the worst presidents the United States has ever had. Because this vaccine, this injection, especially as it could apply to children, if he does not help stop it, will go wrong as the greatest public health disaster. Because there's absolutely no basis, there's no medical, no scientific justification for vaccinating children who, with these vaccines, this particular set. So, first of all, it was not needed. The vaccines, in my point of view, were never needed, and I stated that. I'm on record, I'm arguing this constantly. I think because of early outpatient treatment, because of hydroxy and ivermectin, just the whole compendium. And remember, I'm not singling out any drug. We're talking about a combined sequenced approach. I think that we could have dealt with this properly with early treatment and also taking the common sense approaches. If we would have stopped this fraudulent, corrupted PCR test, because that was what was used to have us still in this position. If there are two things we could do this morning in this call, and somebody say, Paul, give us just two steps, two things we can do instantly in the world to change things, I would say, one, stop all PCR testing, all, just complete garbage. And two, just open up your society. Once you could stop the PCR test and you could just make the decision, let's just go back to life as normal, in my view, we'll be able to deal with this, because they've had 19 months. If any government or any health system says, we need to lock down because we need to get our health system prepared, I would have to then say, we should fire you. We should not only fire you, we should strip you of your pension and take every cent that you were paid the last 19 months, because you asked us for 2 weeks to prepare the hospitals. You've had 19 months, and you're still telling me you need to prepare the hospitals. So we need to fire you and incur penalties on you even, because you now have costed lives. So that's garbage. The hospitals are prepared. They're ramped up. It's just bogus. So from my point of view, I think that these vaccines, This is the hill that we have to be prepared to die on for children, because as Dr. Bridle has said, when we look at these vaccines properly and we see the harms that are emerging in the adults in terms of the clots, the bleeding, the 15,000 deaths in VAERS, which only captures 1%, 25,000 deaths in the UDRA, Europe system, again, which only captures a few, it means that there's a problem, a serious problem. Dr. Bridle, I think this is what we need to explain to the world. And I'll end my quick spiel here to build on what he said. I just did an op-ed on, and it was published, saying that we should consider our children effectively. My thesis: one, Dr. Bridle properly explained the research by Patel et al. And Bungiewicz et al., which shows that children lack the ACE2 receptor in their nostrils, and thus that provided us a molecular basis for why children were not getting infected readily in the first place or even getting ill. There's also groundbreaking research recently by Losk et al. That showed that the upper airways of children are already pre-activated and sensitized with the innate, the antiviral, it's a pre-activated innate immunity that's already primed for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, makes them much more nimble in their approach. And number three, we have research by Yang et al. Recently that also showed that...
You're once again frozen.
Maybe you're mute still.
Oh yeah, we can see you, Paul. We can see you. You were just mentioning that there's a new study out, or you? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we lost you. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, you were just talking about the new study by Young others.
Is that a study by? Did you say Young?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me just finish that, because what Dr. Bridle has said is so critical. The study by Yang et al. Showed that the B cells, children, they found in the blood, children had memory B cells that were sensitized already to SARS-CoV-2 because of prior common cold coronavirus exposures. And there was one more piece by Weisberg and Ferber, which showed that the T cells in children's immune system was so naive and untrained that it allows their response to be much more nimble and potent. And that's why children, their argument was that naive set of T cell response allowed children to be much more the response was so much more rapid and potent and allowed them to have less infection and to not go on to develop such serious disease. So my argument is in line with Dr. Bridle's, which is collectively, when you take these pieces of information, particularly I read there's a study by Gallo et al. Which showed that they looked at household transmission just to show. We knew this over 15 months, but we have the studies. We have the Swedish study by Ludvigsson, which showed that of the 2 million Swede kids under 16 that they followed with no lockdowns, no masks, they found not one instance of death from COVID in Sweden. We have the Danish-French Alps study, and not the Danish, Danis was the author of French Alps, which looked at one child who was infected in around mid-2020. They went to three different schools, interacted with a host of teachers and students, about 120 close contacts. And they followed all of the contacts, and they found that not one instance was there secondary transmission from child. And the Gallo study showed that no child transmitted to child, only the adult teachers transmitted to the children. So we knew, and we knew, and we know that children do not transmit to other children or to adults. It's always adult down to child. So collectively, my argument is leave the children alone, consider children already immune, and consider them vaccinated, fully vaccinated already. They need no vaccine. These molecular and biological explanations support that thesis. And what Dr. Birdle is trying to say is, if you bypass the ACE2 limitation the children have, that natural protection in the nasal passage, in the upper respiratory tract, etc., and you enter the deltoid, and that spike and the content of the vaccine gets into the circulation in children, and the spike, etc., if it's expressed in the shoulder, gets in to the circulation, we could begin to see deaths in children at a level that we're seeing in adults now. So where children have been spared thus far, we are going to see many children die. In fact, I'll say it this way. I will go one step further than Dr. Brittle. So I'll say it. I am saying that if we vaccinate children, many, many children in the United States, Canada, Britain, wherever, not may die, but will die. They will die from the consequences of the vaccine based on what we're seeing today in this. You may say, well, it's a theoretical risk, but we have the evidence. We have the evidence already that's happening. We see what's happening in teens with myocarditis, with CVST, et cetera. So this is not just a discussion. We have data now we could point to. So if children have been spared so far, as Dr. Birdle eloquently explained, with this natural protection that somebody gave it, God or whomever you want to say, why would we bypass that natural protection and put them at risk? And we run the risk of killing thousands of children, and is that serious? And we need to have that kind of discussion very seriously. And if, as I laid out in those studies, there seem to be an ability of children to be molecularly and biologically protected in the first place, why would we bypass it?
It doesn't make any sense.
After everything that we've learned from all of the experts, including you, and Byram and all the others, from Peter McCullough, Roger Hodgkinson, who is very outspoken, we know, one, there was never a corona pandemic, but rather a PCR test pandemic. Two, there were always, no one denies that there's a virus out there, but there have always been alternative methods of treatment that are effective and not dangerous. What we're seeing now with these vaccines, and as you pointed out, with respect to the children, they're deadly. They're potentially deadly.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we all could have, after 19 months, our different views of what could be done. But look, right now I'm in the United States, and for family reasons, etc., I re-enter Canada, and I'm moving around. I've been in Florida the last couple of weeks, etc., for meeting. I've been in D.C., etc. When you look at the way different people are behaving, for example, you go down to Florida, the sun is shining, people are out, no masks, people are going about their life, people are going into certain places, they put on their masks to go into the restaurant or in a congregated setting. You see, we need to just wake up and say, stop it. Stop this crazy, nonsensical, illogical madness. There's no basis. There's no basis that I could be in the Niagara, New York side, 1 mile away, or half of a mile, and cross into Canada, and I need to have on a mask to go into any facility. Yet when I cross just a few hundred feet into New York, I could go about my life, I could go into a gym, etc., normally. So there's a bunch of madness. There's no scientific basis for a lot of what they're doing, none. That in Ontario, in Toronto, if I walk into the restaurant, I need to have on a mask. But when I sit down, I could take off the mask. And while I'm sitting, people could walk in without masks if they're coming to order takeout food. So you need to understand, this virus is so sophisticated that If in my mind I am coming into the restaurant to sit, I need to have a mask on. But if you are coming in and your intent is to go to the counter and buy takeout and hang around there and wait for it, you could be without the mask and the virus knows this. So it's just a whole load of BS. It's just to me, I have seen it where it's almost these bureaucrats and technocrats behind the scenes who just suck off the teeth. They suck off the teeth of the taxpayer. They've never held a proper job in their life. They don't even know how business operates. They don't know the suffering they're causing on business owners and on employees with these edicts and these. They just sit down in their little room somewhere in a little meeting with a coffee, and they come out, okay, let's do this to them now. Let's do that. Let's do this and see. You know, it's like the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, a few months ago, he came up with a bizarre ruling. I think that empowered police, that if you came down your driveway, there was a lockdown, such a heavy lockdown in that period, I think that you couldn't even come off your own driveway, that you could be stopped, interrogated, and you could even be arrested and fined. The public immediately went nuts. More importantly, the police went nuts and said, no, we're not going to enforce that. We're going to tear the society apart. They came by the next morning and said, okay, we're not going to do that one. So in other words, their public health edicts are not based on science or a need. Because let me say it this way. If you told me, I'm an epidemiologist, an infectious disease expert, if you said, Paul, this pathogen has a 40% mortality, this is like MERS, okay? This have a 50% mortality, or just like Ebola, but it's aerosolized. That's a huge, huge problem. I will help you sell locking my society down for as long as it takes until we deal with it. But this was never it. So the problem is they have exacted a toll. They have done things across the world to people. Like what the madness, it is sheer utter madness in Australia for something that was less deadly than the seasonal influenza, particularly for children. I know it's heavier in the high-risk people. But what they have done here is so... It's not even unreasonable. It is so wrong because they have taken the tools of public health and wasted them now. The public will not believe these people in the future when we have a real, serious, lethal pathogen in our hands, and it will come. So we have these politicians sticking their finger in the wind to see what could I do today that will make part of the population feel that I'm doing something and enough so that the rest will comply. Well, when Doug Ford tried that and even the police pushed back, he had to change it. So that meant that it had no basis, because if it was really needed for the public's health, he did not have to reverse it. He could have made the argument to the public and he could have even used legal means. But he reversed it because there was no basis. You can't reverse something that was needed for the public's health if the public says no. No, your position there is to safeguard the public, and you would have had credible basis even to enforce it legally and take draconian steps, but you had none. So to me, if you ask me and I looking on, I would say, this pandemic, this thing that they call it, was over 15 months ago. 15 months ago, they've just been playing with us and seeing how long they could stretch this out for. There's no basis for none of this, none. They overcycled the PCR test and used it to cause this madness, so that they could sell this asymptomatic garbage. Asymptomatic spread was bogus. Recurrent infection was bogus. There's no credible basis for those. None. So the problem is, though, that I think they scared the population so much. I know. When Fauci and they came onto the podium every day. That's why I said Trump should have fired these bastards. Every day they would come and make you feel But 15-year-old Johnny, at the prime of his life, healthiest Johnny, was at the same risk. They said, we are all at equal risk of severe outcome and death if infected. So Johnny got in his mind on Susie that at 15, I could die like my 85, 90-year-old granny with four underlying conditions. And it is that message that they drilled across the world, drilled into the minds of the population that stuck. And even today, Johnny will not fully come out to play because Johnny thinks that he's still at risk as his granny. And Johnny will put on two masks and go and take a jog in the forest with nobody around him for 15 miles. But he has on a mask and he'll even have on gloves. That's how crazy Johnny is today.
That tells you about the psychological effects that all of this is going to have, not just now, but in the long term. Psychologists expect the worst possible.
Yes, I agree. So right now we just need the leadership to stand up and say enough, stop it, stop the garbage, stop the insanity, stop the PCR testing, just stop it. Yeah. It's garbage. Yeah. It's 100% false positive. Throw it away. Stop it. Open your society. Go on with life. If somebody gets ill, I'm sorry. This is how I look at it today. You take care of your elderly. Look, let me tell you something. I come from the islands. Well, you know that. I have family in the islands. I took my parents back to the Caribbean. My parents are elderly, so they want to die there. Okay. That's personal business. But I'm just saying, my sister who they live with, from the time this began 19 months ago, she's taken care of them in their private home. We talk every day. So the game is to keep them out of the hospital. That's how we should have spoken to the population and say, look, your private people in your home, your parents, your elderly, even if your parents happen to live by themselves, you need to take care of them. It's your personal business. It's not my business. It's not my business what happened to your family. I need to take care of mine. It's my responsibility. You can't lock children down, close schools, suffer the rest of society because I can't take care of my family. It's my personal business. My sister is an example. Not wealthy people, poor people. But she took care of my parents. My parents have been locked down, restricted. She'll take them out now and again, restrict people who come near them if she doesn't understand their risk. And she's taken sensible precautions. She had early outpatient treatment, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, the whole gamut in the household. She knows the treatment protocol. She's working with a doctor if in case they get infected, etc. She even went put them on the early treatment protocol, and life has gone on. Yes, they can't go out as much as they want because the virus in some places is still circulating, but she's taken personal responsibility for her family. It's not society to be shut down because people can't do this for their family. That's number one. Number two, the nursing homes and old age homes operate properly and take care of the elderly. It was killing fields there. 90% of the deaths in Ontario, as an example, in Canada, happened in our old age homes. And while I was in the Trump administration, we were seeing that the deaths were happening in the old age homes because of the staff. The staff in these homes are good people. They're not wealthy, and they have to go 3 to 4 different old age homes during the day to make up a full-time wage. So they're part-time here, a few hours there. And they were bringing infection into the homes. They were transmitting it. And yet we were not stopping the staff. You know, other countries had models where you would take a complete floor of the facility. And I was in meetings where I explained this. But no one takes you on. The bureaucracy, they weren't interested. It was going in here and coming out here. I told the decision makers, Make a regulatory rule, force these facilities to designate a complete floor only for staff. So every on a 2-week basis, once infection enters, staff can't leave. Ask them, but don't fire them. If they say, well, I can't stay because I have family obligations, let them go and pay them to stay home if they want. Then turn to nursing schools. where people want the practical experience and the income, those 2-year, 4-year students, bring them in, let them, and let them stay for a couple of weeks while the infection is there, tamp down the infection, get it under control. Some people rented a hotel across the street from the old age home, the nursing home, and staff would just cross the street into the hotel. So they won't. So you have more control of the staff because the staff was the rate limiting step. And many of our parents and grandparents died because of staff bringing the infection in. And if that is not fixed, many will continue to die. But you know what's the interesting thing? The interesting thing is that what COVID has revealed to us is some sad commentaries. And one of them is, we never really were concerned about in a society about our elderly. Okay. And once your grandparent or your parent got a certain age, you put them in an old age home, in a care home or a long-term facility, and out of sight, out of mind. You didn't even visit them. And I know because I have in-laws in old age homes in Ontario. So I've seen every part of this pandemic and what is done to them and the suffering. They have months they don't even bathe. They don't even get a shower because nobody would come into them. They're in isolation when the nursing home locks down, when the old age home, when there's an outbreak, when staff brings it in. They have to lock them in their 5x5 room. It's a terrible, it is probably, the elderly in our society is the most prized people. The most, it's the best of us. Yet, when we put them there or they decide to enter, they are treated like the worst of the worst. It's like, I go there and people don't even visit their parents or their grandparents. I stand up there and talk to people because they're lonely. And then when you put this pandemic on top of that and you isolate these people, they spend the last few months of their life in pure misery. And the reality is that we would go to bed normally in your life and everybody's life. And you didn't realize this, that black or white morgue van would pull up into the back of the nursing homes across the world every night and take people who passed. But it never registered in you that our elderly die from illnesses every day because they're old. They have a limited immune system and they've come to the end of their life, and these respiratory viruses, particularly pneumonia, etc., end their life. And what we've done with COVID has shown us that elderly were treated. It was so devastating to them. I think it was, I consider it a crime. And I want, at the end of this, many, many people in the highest levels of government, in all of those bureaucratic agencies, I want them to be held accountable. I want them investigated, and I want them, their money taken away from them. I want every benefit they ever gotten stripped, and I want them held accountable. I want them fired. I want them fined. I mean, I don't talk people, you know, when you talk to other people, oh, people have to go to jail. I don't use those words. But people need to be held accountable by the harshest means possible. We need to figure out what that is, because we must never, ever let this happen again. We must never put emergency power into the hands of these government officials again, because they abused the emergency powers that they were given. They became electable. We have no pandemic, none. There's no pandemic now, nothing. We just need to open up and let societies go forward. We just need to stop all this mad testing crap and let people live their lives and get out of their lives. And if you have an elderly person in your care, take care of your people, take care of your family in your home. And when they need care, find the care, get them to the hospital, do what you need to do. Don't sit back there and be part of the society destroying the young and healthy and destroying the rest of society because of your failures. This is the point. You people need to take personal responsibility for their private homes and also make sure that your parents are well taken care of in the nursing homes, hold the nursing homes.com, etc. The hospitals are geared up. They had 19 months. No one can say that they have no. Listen, I could count 9 different doctors in different hospitals in Canada, as an example, who've told me all this thing on the news about overloaded and stretched and no beds is a lie. It's a lie. Everything is just bogus. They're working in the emergency room. He said, no. So, of course, the media is the rate limiting step for us. I regard anything the media says as a bogus lie. I tell anyone, anything that the media says, regardless of where, don't even listen to it. It's a lie.
Well, you know, that brings us to the point at which we have to realize it's not just the governmental officials who need to be held accountable. It is also those who are trying to pull their or are pulling their strings in the background.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree fully. Mm. Yes.
It's well, Paul, this was very important, not just because of the information that you gave us, but also because of it is important to show that this is an emotional kind of thing, because we, in particular, when you pointed out that many of us are probably responsible, not just during COVID times, but are probably responsible of not taking good enough care of our elderly people.
Yes.
And that's what it boils down to. This is about humanity. This is about empathy, and it's about showing emotions. That's what we have to relearn, because that is probably something that the other side, has been trying to separate us from.
I'll close off because I have, and I know you have other interviews. I'll close off with something. So I am working with Byron Brittle and other people like Dr. Charles Hoff, Dr. Francis Christian, Dr. Roger Hodkinson, Dr. Mark Trozzi. This is a Canadian group. Mm-hmm. But I'm working also, and I know you know this, I'm working daily with Peter McCullough, Dr. Harvey Reich, Dr. Howard Tenenbaum. So with yourselves sitting here is a core 10, 15, 20 of us who are on the front lines daily, interviewing people, you bringing in. So we are fighting, and I understand that. We are trying to get the message out and share. We are prognosticators. You know, we want this to fix. We want to help. We want this to end well. We are dissidents from the point of view that we are not just agreeing with what is being told to us. We are questioning it because we want the best to be done now, because everything that they've done so far has failed. Mm-hmm. We looked at all of the evidence on lockdowns, school closures, masks, mask mandates, everyone, every study, every report, nothing, not one. No one can show where anything has been successful. And I will end by saying this. The FBI released something. I saw a report yesterday that the number of murders and stuff in the United States have gone up, like, I think they said 25%, something like that, from last year or two. So I read this report. It's there. It's on the news. So immediately, I've been saying this the last month, and I'll share it with you here. The mask, the face mask, your eyes and your face and your facial expression really is a portal into your heart and your soul. It tells me everything about you just by looking at you and talking to you, and the animation on your face and the animation on mine. It connects me and you from a humanity point of view. Even when we don't know each other, we just glancingly saw each other in the elevator, as an example. When you mask someone, and you have people walking around with masks for the last 19 months, including children, you are stopping that humanity connection, that thing that we have, where we could look at each other's face and in half of a second know the story, and we know this person is good, you know, safe, this person. You know, like if this person is inviting, if this person is collegial to me, whatever. You can see by yourself. But not just that, it goes past just the physical aspect. we connect with human beings on a deep level by our face. And when you hide it, you end that connection, and it breaches that, and it allows human to human now, no connection. It allows me to go places emotionally that I would not go before. And to end, I will say it this way. When the executioner is charged with putting someone to death in the execution chamber, if you notice at the end, they mask the person, executioner and the person, for a reason, or they put a blind. Because if the executioner sees the face of the person, they will not be able to carry out that final act. They need to see your face. Even if I didn't know you, it tells me you're a human being like me. I can't do this to you. By masking our population and our children, we have set our societies up. We are going to see levels of depravity and crime in the future, near and distant future that we've never seen before. And we will, with the social scientists, we'll be running around pulling the hair out of their head. How did this happen? This mask is not just worthless. We study the science. It is ineffective in stopping the pathogen, source control in every way. We looked at the Danish mask study. We looked at the Paris Island Marine study. We looked at the CDC 2020 non-pharmaceutical intervention study. We looked at every study. Even the Bangladesh study recently is junk. It's junk science. I studied it. It's garbage. Cloth masks are ineffective and a modest effect, 11% for the surgical mask. But if you look at it, it's highly confounded. You can't make, I'm a methodologist. You toss that in the garbage, all of it. No one did a proper study except the Danish mask. No one. Why? Because they didn't want the results, because it would have shown them conclusively with a proper comparative effectiveness research study. The masks are junk, those masks. Bill Orr in 1981 published a study that showed us, he's a surgeon in 1981, it's a famous study, that in the surgical field, when they looked at surgeons who were masked versus unmasked, what was shocking was the unmasked surgeons caused less infection to the wounds of their patients than the masked ones. The masked surgeons caused more infection. And the only thing we theorize is because when they were breathing into the mask, the infections from them were coming down on the base and falling onto the open wounds as they operated. It's because we needed to figure out, well, this is upside down. That the mass surgeons cause infection. And yeah, we figured it out because all of the air was coming down. So what's the bottom line? The masks have been a catastrophic failure, not just from a biological or an ability to curb the transmission, but it will cause people to commit crimes against each other because we have hidden our faces. Mm-hmm. All right.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's horrible, but I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So I know you guys are busy and I have another meeting now. And you know, I'm so privileged. It's been difficult lining up time because you know, we have many people want to talk. Everybody wants a meeting and all of that. But your group.
We missed the last couple of sentences, Paul.
All I'm trying to say is I am very grateful that you would allow me to partake. And there's so much we have to share.
Yeah.
And everybody's torn apart right now with different meetings and discussions. But anytime in the future that I could be part of your groups, please, please, please ask me. And I would love to be. I very much admire the work that you all are doing. Very, very much. I'm very privileged to be on this show.
And vice versa. We are very grateful for your input and your emotions, too. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Oh.